and also now in India, even though many of the poorest countries are still lagging behind in growth, both those two countries and also the rich countries. But there is now very heavily increasing intranational inequality, which leads to a continuous increase in global inequality, which I define as inequality among individual beings or individual households worldwide. So if you ignore for the moment all national borders and just think of all human beings as individuals, you'll find that inequality among these individuals is rapidly increasing. It's increasing, interestingly, in a way that leaves behind the traditional bases of inequality. It used to be highly correlated with race, with sex, nationality, language, caste, religion, sexual preference, and so on. These inequalities are still very much with us, but they are receding. There is an end in sight. I think they are in decline. And despite that fact that these group-correlated inequalities are declining, sheer anonymized inequality is still dramatically increasing. So current trends point to a future in which we will find massive increases in social, political, and economic inequalities that will no longer be heavily correlated with these traditional markers of inferiority such as race, sex, nationality, language, and so on. These are the latest figures. We don't have figures beyond 2005 yet, but these are the latest figures about the extent of inequality. So here you just take, again, the whole world population and slice them up like a salami into 20 equal slices, each one 350 million people, and you look at what the average income is, so the income of these various slices. What you see here, first and foremost, is that the inequality is absolutely massive. People in the top 5%, which is roughly the top 30% of the people living in the rich countries. In the top 5%, you have people having income that's 9 times the average income in the world. If you go down to the bottom half, you find that people have, in the third quarter, 1/12 of the average income in the world, and people in the bottom quarter even have only 1/32 of the average income. What you also find, and that's a little bit more pertinent still for the topic of justice, is that the trend is really going very dramatically against justice here, or at least against what you might call justice by some very minimal criteria thereof, namely against the fulfillment of the basic needs of the poor. The bottom half of the world's population has now been reduced to below 3% of global household income. The bottom quarter has been reduced to something like 0.75% of global household income. And when you look at the trend between 1988 and 2005, 17-year short period characterized by globalization, you find that 1/20th, one slice of these 20 slices did really well for itself, namely the top slice. They gained 3.5% of global household income. All the other slices lost, except the second slice was sort of flat, and people at the bottom lost the most. They lost fully 1/3 of their extremely meager share of global household income in just 17 years. Now, these enormous disparities, 300-1, right? The top 5% have 9 times average income, the bottom quarter have 1/32 of national income, a 300-1 ratio is, of course, is partly based on professional success. It's the people who do well in their profession who make it to the top, but that's only a small factor. A much more important factor, 80% of the observed variation in income worldwide is based on just nationality, the most important, and the social position of your parents. I cannot predict precisely where you will end up when I know these two things about you, but I can predict pretty well where you will end up in the global income hierarchy. Nationality and socioeconomic position. So don't think that this is all earned. If you had been born in Bangladesh, as my friend Warren Buffett once memorably said, you would not have become as rich as you now are. Now, this increasing inequality, this very rapidly increasing inequality, and especially the rapidly reducing share of the poorest quarter and the poorest half of world population, of course, has consequences for the fulfillment of basic needs. You see here the statistics from the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, how many people are chronically undernourished? How many of you know that a new record was set in 2009 where this number, for the first time ever, breached the 1 billion mark? It wasn't really very much in the press, but it was a very important landmark. The first time in all of human history, we had more than 1 billion people chronically undernourished. Chronically undernourished means not just that you skip a meal here or there, but that you are basically permanently hungry. You never have enough to eat. And that number has gone up pretty much since the mid-90s during that same period. And I've flagged the number for 1996 in red because that was the famous time where at the World Food Summit in Rome, all the governments of the world came together and promised that they would halve the number of chronically undernourished people by 2015. That number has never looked back. It's gone up, and it will reach the record again this year because of rising food prices. Now, this is the largest of all the human rights deficits in the world today, namely basically social and economic rights, as you see here in Article 25 of the Universal Declaration. Everyone has a right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of him or herself and his or her family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, necessary social services, and so on. That's a very fundamental human right, and it's a human right that for very large numbers of people is not fulfilled today, and further hundreds of millions live at the edge of not having the object of that right, in permanent vulnerability of falling into a condition where one or more of these basic needs will be unfulfilled. I quickly run by you the numbers. 7 billion people is what we are this year. We are breaching a new billion milestone. And of them, as you can see, many people are deprived in various dimensions. For example, chronic undernutrition, access, lack of access to essential medicines, lack of access to safe drinking water, often a cause of diarrhea, which is in many cases deadly, lack of access to adequate shelter, electricity, adequate sanitation, again a big cause of disease, and illiteracy and child labor. So these are a few of the deprivations that are still near the billion mark or well above. Now, maybe the most dramatic figure is that of premature deaths, and it's roughly a third of all people who die every day, every week, every year, who die from poverty-related causes, 18 out of 57 million a year. And this is a conservative estimate, which I made by simply looking at only those causes of death, which are essentially unheard of in the rich countries. There are people in the poor countries who die of the same things we die from. They die of cancer, diabetes, heart disease, and so on. And they often die much sooner than we do because they have lousy medical care. But I've not counted any of those deaths in order to keep the calculation simple and straightforward. So only those causes of death that are unique essentially to the poor countries, and here they are with their figures, are counted, and they already are 18 million or one third of all human deaths. You can see this here. We talked about the Second World War, the biggest catastrophe of the 20th century, killed about 60 million people, including the gulags and the concentration camps. And hunger and disease and poverty is killing, in just the last 20 years, about 380 million people at the rate of 18 million a year. And we don't really think about it. We don't really know much about it. Now, it's a long story to think about what explains that, how this comes to be, but of course an important element in that story, I think, is the rules, and in particular the supranational rules, which have assumed enormous importance in recent years. Globalization is many things. For you, it's Facebook, perhaps, and Twitter. But what it is much more profoundly is that the rules that dominate our social life, our economic life, our political life, have shifted upward in a massive way, very rapidly, from the national level to the global level. And that's in many ways a good thing, but it's also in some ways a very bad thing. In particular, it's not a gain for democracy, and it's not a gain for transparency and accountability. Few of us, few people in the world, have any kind of influence on what governments decide behind closed doors about what the content of these rules is going to be. They're being negotiated by the most powerful governments, and these governments, of course, are influenced and lobbied by some agents, but only the richest, most powerful agents are in a position to do so, large companies, banks, industry associations, and so on. And so we have